Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, inmates at Bedlam, random dead marshals, whoever else might be out there listening in TV land. You are listening to The Demimond. This is a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em. Hi, television neighbor. I'm glad we're together again.
Welcome.
Okay, so first off, we want to thank everybody for the reviews we've received recently. Please keep them coming. We spend a lot of time producing this podcast, and it's encouraging to have others let us know that they like it.
I have the piece finished that I'm going to put up. Now, I made three just to make sure that one of them came out right, because I've had issues with glazes and other things in the past. Now, because I love our listeners, you know, and I love everything that we do, I've decided to go with the one that you guys saw originally.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. Now,
that is a good piece.
I love this piece to death now, because there was something happened with the glaze on the inside of the cup itself, to where it still holds water and everything looks good, but it just feels penny dreadfully. You know, there's imperfections in the glaze. You can see the bottom of it. And I didn't glaze the outside of it, so you have that kind of old world feel. And after watching this episode, it has kind of like a dry desert feel, because it's raw clay from the high fire. So it's really good. I have it here. So if we can get more. Can you guys see that?
I can. Yeah. Cool. That looks awesome.
I came home Sunday, sat down, and actually drank out of it. And to the listener that gets it, you're getting like I don't say this very often, it's a nice piece of art. You know, you should be able to enjoy it as much as I do. You know, I'm even going to name it, catalog it. And what you have to know if you win is that you have to really clean it well, you know, by hand, because of the imperfections. You know, it's just a smart thing to do.
So the number we're going for is 52.
Yeah, I think so. I think 52.
All right,
you know,
ten more reviews before the end of the season.
And you actually have to write something. So if you just click on some stars, we don't know who you are. We don't see who that is. If you want to be a contestant for this, you have to actually write something about us.
And as good as this piece is, it also has the added bonus of Paul already said that he drank out of it. He's not going to wash it before he sends it to you. So think about that.
Full of DNA.
Some incentive. There it is, folks.
And I'm no master, you know. I like this because as time has gone, you can look at some of the different pieces that people have won and seen a little bit of progression in my work. So, you know, you're not going to get anything amazing, but, you know, this piece has probably 20, 25 hours into it,
damn,
maybe a little less. So it's a nice one. So please, everybody, you know, give us a little love.
And you're not going to find it anywhere else.
No, one of a kind, collector's item.
So, also, you know, if you're not into writing reviews, there's other ways to support us. We just got another subscriber. If you go to our website at noship.net, click on our support page, you can find other ways where you can support us monetarily or even just by clicking on our Amazon link. So take a look at that.
Speaking of the new subscriber, and you know who you are, thank you very much. That was awesome.
All right, so we are discussing Penny Dreadful Season 3, Episode 5, This World is Our Hell, which is written by Andrew Hinderaker. It is not written by John Logan today, and also directed by Paco Cabezas. All right, so before we launch into recap, what are your thoughts on this episode?
Wow, what a difference. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's a whole different attitude, and then we get so much information. It was phenomenal. And then they're dicks for leaving us off the way they did. I was a little disappointed, right? I was working in the studio and I look up because it, you know, went quiet and was like, oh, what the, you jerks.
Well, I knew right off the bat that this was not going to be as good as the last episode. And by this, I don't mean to sound like I was disappointed in any way, shape, or form, but whereas the last episode was definitely a solid 10 on any of the rating scales that we want to use, this was probably right at a good 9, I think. And I think it only gets a 9 and not more because you're coming off of the heels of the last episode, which, I mean, I think we're all in agreement on this, the three of us and the listenership as well, that was probably easily the best episode of the season so far, if not the best episode of the entire show. So, you know, even though I knew it wasn't going to be as good, it was still great. Just like Paul said, it was still great. You get a lot of changes in scenery. not really a lot of changes of scenery. You go to the desert and then you get the Bedlam Laboratory and that's really it. But the vibrancy of it, the colors of it all, just the sheer scope of it going from this, you know, one room mm-hmm. and two characters with a third mm-hmm. kind of just playing a cameo role almost to this big landscape with everything else going on. And I think that's part of the genius of the show. John Logan knows when to zoom in and like pull out. So, yeah.
So this was actually filmed in Spain. Did you guys know that? They weren't filming this in the U.S.
Yeah.
Texas Hollywood, it's called.
Yeah.
Texas Hollywood?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty funny. I saw it on a documentary recently, and they said Penny Dreadful, and I was like, hey,
so that's
interesting.
Is that where they film a lot of Western stuff? That's supposedly the Old West?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because even the person that was doing the documentary was from England and was like, this looks like California. You wouldn't even know. He's just driving. He's like, you wouldn't even know you're in Spain. You know, it's awesome.
Yeah. It fooled me. It fooled me. I thought they were on location, but it, you know, really, it makes a lot more sense for them to do shooting in Europe.
Okay, so this episode opens in the desert, and we have a pair of galloping hoops that bring Ethan and Hecate flying into our view. The two stop briefly, and Ethan points out a riverbed up ahead. They hear the marshals are still close on their tail. So next, we see that Malcolm Murray and Kayatane are not too far behind the marshals. Kayatane intends to acquire new horses and be upon the marshals by nightfall. He busies himself making a spear. Kayatane is willing to slaughter all the marshals to save Ethan and gladly give up his own life if it comes down to it. Suspicious, Malcolm Murray asks if Ethan would do the same for him. Kayatane said Ethan would kill him the first chance he gets.
And once you know why, you don't blame him.
No, honesty.
Because I've grown to like K-Town a little bit over these last episodes, but I think he would probably deserve to die for what he's done.
Well, now see, hold on a second, because when we get to it, I might be on K-Town's side a little bit on this.
Okay. All right. Yeah. We'll have a good
discussion. I don't want to say on his side, but I kind of understand what happened.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So when we get to it, I've got a little bit of theory.
We didn't actually see him use that spear he was making, right?
Well, there's a deleted...
No, I don't think so.
There's a deleted s'mores scene is what's going on.
While they're all sleeping, yeah. He jacks like little bits from each one to make a s'more.
All right, so now Ethan is at the now dry riverbed. He has a flashback to a time when the river flowed and blood was on his hands. A lot of it. He reports to Hecate that there will not be a source of water for days. Hecate asks why Ethan's father hunts him down. Ethan says his father wants him to answer for what he did, and the only decent thing about him is the shame that he feels. The shame that Ethan feels, I should, not his father.
Mm-hmm.
So Hecate talks of how his god tortures him with guilt and then offers what? Ethan says, forgiveness. And she asks, do you feel forgiven? There is only one way to free yourself of guilt. Embrace your sins.
Whew. Man, she's good.
I like the stuff she's saying in this, not because I necessarily agree with it philosophically, but this is textbook Satanism, not devil worship Satanism, like the goofy movie caricature. But if you were to actually meet a living, breathing Satanist.
Like Anton LaVey Satanism?
Yeah, like that kind of thing, to where they have a philosophy on life to where it's kind of like it's just the opposite of a lot of Christian stuff. So instead of turn the other cheek, it's eye for an eye. It's do as thou wilt rather than, you know, what is commanded of me, Lord, type of thing. So I think John Logan is interjecting some really cool stuff in here, philosophically speaking, because it's reflective of what a lot of actual Satanists believe. Just for the record, I'm not one. So that's out there. I just know a little bit about stuff here and there. That's all.
And this episode was written by Andrew Hinderaker.
Okay. All right. But I'm saying Logan because I assume that he has final say on whatever gets into the script.
Okay. So this is where she starts to twist him her way, if you believe that he has been turned or not, and we'll get to that. So, and I just want to point out that we have to buy that Ethan's wolf, werewolf side has equal pull on his desires. We just haven't really seen it depicted very much. So mm-hmm. what happens later, it seems sudden to me because we haven't seen that pull toward the dark side on him. He always seemed actually firmly footed in the good, you know.
Well, he's surrounded by good people also before. You know, he's always had Ives and Malcolm Murray and all these good people around him kind of helping him. Even when Sembene and him were in the dungeon, he was like, this is me, I'm a monster. And he's like, Sembene kind of like talks him out of it. You know what I mean? So he's had such a good supporting cast helping him. Now you've got somebody with a silver tongue that is like, why feel guilty? You're an amazing thing. You know, be what you are and you won't feel this pain and suffering anymore. So he's like, he's easily swayed by peer pressure.
Yeah, it's, I was going to say peer pressure. And one of the things I didn't mention in the intro is that part of the charm of this episode, besides giving us so much visually to soak up, it also gives us a lot of information, like Paul said, and it's also delivering the unexpected. There's some stuff. When Ethan says yes at one point, that blindsided me. I was like, what?
Yeah. So,
but I think you're right. There is a we have to buy that this is an equal pull here on this, because there's no everything else indicates that that's the truth, and he's not just kind of like taking her for a ride or whatever else may be going on.
Yeah, she combats with Dracula in smoothness and the pimping that she's got going on. She's done her homework. She knows what she needs to say. Even in a scene coming up, I'll bring it up then, that she's really pulling at his heartstrings. So it's interesting.
Okay, so now at the Bedlam Lab, Dr. Jekyll prepares a mild Mr. Balfour for their next enterprise by restraining him. Victor, now bristling with sass and conceit, explains to Balfour the reason for these restraints. He is to be injected with more of the serum, but this time it will be energized with electricity, supposedly ensuring it a permanent efficacy. This injection will be placed right into the prefrontal cortex.
Sassy Vicky. I like it. I like him when he's like this.
I don't really.
Well, he's condescending to his friend really bad. You know, he's very like, oh, I'll fix this for you. And he brings up all kinds of shit that's like, dang, dude, kick a dude while he's down. You know?
This is the dude that you just like unloaded your heart to recently.
Yeah.
You know, at a tea shop or tea place. And then, and also, this is the guy who's developed a serum that's actually giving you some hope.
Yes.
It's just because you can, like, you know, add a little bit of your, I mean, it's still a you know, takes two to tango kind of operation going on here. So
just for the record, I want to say that I like him like this because he's fun to watch, but I completely agree with what you're saying. He's only making an improvement on the work that somebody else has done. So he
it's all right if you want to be besties with him. It's cool.
I mean, out of the two of them, I'd probably hang out with Victor. I don't know. He just seems more my style. The other guy would just get mad at me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I would end up fighting Dr. Jekyll.
So Victor berates Dr. Jekyll about relying on the bloodstream to deliver his impure compound. No wonder Mr. Balfour suffers vestigial memories from the trauma, Victor says. So I have to agree with Steve here that he mentioned before that it does seem that their relationship shifts like a pendulum regarding who's the dominant one.
Yeah, it does. It seems they can't really, they should be trying to share in this optimally and saying like, okay, yeah, we came together and we had two great ideas, my chocolate, your peanut butter type of thing. But because of the scientific intellectual competition between the two of them, they can't quite get to that point. So it's always one of them's, you know, I don't want to get back into the whole top and bottom metaphors here, but you know what we're you know what we're talking about. You know what they kind of reminded me of, if you're a comic book fan, is Reed Richards and Victor Von Doom.
Oh, that's really good.
You know, you've got these two geniuses who are just like at the top of their respective fields and they're best friends, and then there's a rift that's going to happen between them and they're going to become mortal enemies. That I'm just calling that now. Yeah. Huh. So that's how I see it, because of course, you know, Reed Richards goes on to head the Fantastic Four, and then Victor Von Doom becomes Dr. Doom. And that's the vibe that I was getting off of these two.
It's just Victor gets a little nasty, you know, just a pinch like overboard where it's like, dude, this guy's going to freak out and beat your ass. You're going to go home and sniff some panties to make yourself feel better.
Oh, yeah.
So before injecting, Victor promises that Balfour will return an innocent lamb, and promising he will have no memory. Victor supposes it is our memories that makes us monsters, and he then injects the electrified serum into Balfour's prefrontal cortex via his orbital cavity.
Oh my god, that made my toes curl seeing it. It was like, meh.
The scene ends mercifully before Balfour's wails reach peak height.
Now, when Victor's leaning over or leaning to the side of Balfour and he's whispering to him, the only thing I could think of was Victor going, "There ain't no Mouseville, you French fried faggot." Just And not
sticks his finger in his mouth and then not it in putting his ear. His
anyway, that's just me.
Totally understandable.
So you know, I wondered about Victor's memories, or that would be the things that made him monstrous. And at this point, I had thought that it would be the death of his dog and his mother, which you know is what brought him to his obsession with bringing back the dead. In general,
I have to disagree with him. It sounds poetic to say that it's our memories that make us monsters, but I think it's actually our actions that make us monsters. And then if we're lucky, we don't have memories of that. So then we can pretend and mm-hmm. kind of have an ignorance is bliss thing going on and just make believe that none of it happened.
Yeah.
And okay, so now we're back in the American desert. The marshals ready themselves for bed. Junior Inspector rests away from the rest of the group and writes in his journal. Rusk answers the marshal's question about his missing arm. Again, we are reminded that Rusk is a single-minded and tenacious individual.
So this story, when he talks about hunting down somebody and taking them from, like, dragging them through the Transvaal, that's pretty crazy. And you lose your arm, then you hunt down your prey, then you report to the infirmary.
Yeah, he cauterized it himself and then went. So you're dealing with the two different types of wounds, you know. I mean, the cauterization would hurt like a bitch for like a solid week at least, you know, let alone the arm's gone.
So would his memory of that make him a monster at this point?
Well, when he was recounting the story, he got, you know, you could see, you know, the actor did a wonderful job at changing his facial expression and his body. And he looked very menacing, like, I'm going to get my man. I don't care what I have to do.
I think Rusk is about to fall prey to the downside of obsession, because we've praised him up until this point. We've said that he's single-minded, he has tenacity, he has persistence, he has all of the great attributes that you give to somebody mm-hmm. who has that type of mindset. But then at the point where he disavows any code that he's been following, the code is what kept that kind of tiger in its cage, so to speak. So now that he's not doing that, he has the potential to become just as bad of a character as anybody else is doing bad shit.
Oh, for sure.
As Ethan, who's about to let go of a code to let his wolf out of the cage, right? So it's kind of like a
no way, Malcolm Murray's gonna save him. You'll see. He's gonna come in and shoot his dad. Pew!
Hecate.
Oh, then they'll wrestle with Hecate, and he'll have to choose between Malcolm Murray and Hecate.
So speaking of Hecate, from afar but near enough, Hecate admits to Ethan that she is envious of the marshal's fire and feels they flaunt it menacingly. Hecate comforts her dehydrated horse, which endears Ethan to her seemingly. Hecate says she adores all the honest creatures of this world. It is humans she hates.
Liar.
She's
you're a fibber.
She surmises that her and Ethan are similar. She opens up how she first encountered Satan when she was 5 years old. Her mother had given her over to him in service. So obviously the seed of hostility towards her mother was planted very early.
I like this scene because it gives a little bit of depth to Hecate's character, and it makes sense out of the fact that she can seem like a normal person who has the full spectrum of human emotions rather than just this Satan servant kind of thing.
Well, you can't really, it's hard to take what she's saying seriously or to heart, except for maybe what her mom did to her, right? Because she's very similar to Dracula in the simple fact that she's saying something that she knows is going to pull to Ethan's heartstrings. You know, I mean, she's like, oh, I love all animals. I love everything under the sun but humans. You know, it's like, I have a hard time believing this considering the whole Satan and demon thing that she's got going on underneath her regular exterior. It's just it's a very smooth way for Ethan to drop his guard so she can pull out the wolf to use her own needs.
Oh,
just
no
like
doubt she's trying.
Dracula's doing, you know what I mean? And I don't know. You want to believe that story that they say about her mom, but she's a Satanist. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can believe it, you know, because not long after is when he tells his story about what he did. And I love the parallel that you have with Malcolm Murray and Kaitane going on at the same time, kind of doing their own thing. But I don't know, you know, I'm still on extra guard with her. I just think it's smooth hustling on her part.
There's definitely some of that there. But again, that whole strain of actual real life Satanism comes in with that, because her loving the animal fits with that. Because, you know, the satanic view is is to eat each thing being what it is in its truest form. You know what I mean? So that's she views animals as being completely honest. They eat, they fuck, they kill, they exist. That's what they're supposed to do. There's no, you know, so.
Okay. Well, I like
you're
that.
You're probably right, though. She's talking about how she hates the dishonest humans, but she's lying to Ethan at the same time because she's probably mixing lies with the truth at the very least to try to get him to come around to what she's saying.
Ethan now tells how his father enlisted him in the army to make him a man. Ethan said he could have chosen to do otherwise, but he wanted to make his dad proud. He talks of the Apache tribe they slaughtered in the night. He talks of washing the blood off his hands and his commanding officer who dumped a boy's battered body into the river. This commanding officer boasted how they would get medals. Subsequently, Ethan shoots him in the head. Ethan left and brought himself to the last Apache stronghold and offered his scalp. So this was his,
This was his guilt coming out, and he wanted to repent for it. He wanted to make good on it because there's this core of good inside of Ethan. And even though he finds himself sometimes voluntarily, sometimes involuntarily doing really, really bad stuff, I think ultimately he wants to be a good person and he wants to be able to walk in God's light. But
and that seems to be his nature here, right? You know, I mean, he reacted quickly and killed this guy who even, doesn't he call him a friend at some point?
Later on down the road, he says, yeah, I had to kill my friend. Because he's like, I did this, I had to kill my friend. So that, I agree. I think that's what he was talking about later.
This is where he's naturally aligned towards. It's hard for me to believe that he's turned, but then I have, when we get to him, there are some things that seem to go against my disbelief, unfortunately.
Well, it's brutal when he's talking about, you know, the first person they kill is like a girl that's just standing there watching. Mm-hmm. So it was a full slaughter, you know, it was crazy. And then they throw dead bodies up river to pollute the river. You know, it's awful.
The story is now taken up by Kaitane. He, at this time when Ethan offered his scalp, decided it would make Ethan suffer more for him to live and to kill his own people. Kaitane talks of the terrible incessancy of the soldiers hunting the Apaches down and how this was reducing his tribe one by one. As the Apaches died, they turned cruel and did monstrous things, and he looks off with a distant look in his eyes, so don't know quite what that is, as possibly what led to Ethan becoming a wolf, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Could be.
Or whatever the reason why Kaitane is called the old demon. I'm still wondering about Kaitane. I'm not totally sold that he's out for Ethan's best interest.
I took that to mean when he says we did cruel and monstrous things, I took that to mean that when at the end of the episode, whenever Ethan's dad is telling him about what happened to his sister, Kaitane was doing that.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
So that's the cruel and monstrous. You don't really need to be anything else to be more cruel and monstrous than that, but perhaps there is. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's another element to it.
Well, what I don't understand about that is Ethan seems to be hearing about that for the first time. So I don't know why Ethan.
Well, because he said he was at the stable. He was in the stables getting the horses. Yeah. They kept Ethan away from the entire thing. So he never really found out 100%, except maybe heard a little bit of what happened. And it sounds like right after that, they split off. And that's when he went to Europe. He was like, fuck it. Because he was like, that's when I lost my son.
And so, and just hearing that his family died was enough for him to hate Kaitane as much as he does. Like, he doesn't know the details.
For sure. Because remember in their spirit meeting, he's like, did you have to slaughter all of them? You know, when they're bantering about keep a sea apart from us.
Oh, see, I didn't remember that line. Okay. Mm-hmm. Huh. Okay.
Did you slaughter all of them? I was like, who's all of them? Who'd you kill? You know?
Now, back to Hecate. She says, no matter what cruel things you were up to, God was watching it all and said and did nothing. She asks Ethan if he will allow her to summon up demons to kill the marshals. Shall we unleash demons in thee and me? And he agrees. So she has to use his blood to...
It's pretty
which
cool.
Actually, I'll mention that later. So
that was I was so happy he said yes.
That was the surprise. I was not expecting that.
Mm-mm.
So Malcolm Murray and Kaitane are possibly on the same page because it seems that Malcolm Murray is willing to kill them all, even though there seems to be a little bit of hesitancy, but he does at least go and help try to release horses. I don't know if he was planning on helping in the killing part, though. So now Hecate begins her summoning by scrawling symbols in the dirt. She needs to add Ethan's blood to unlock its powers. He offers his hand. The junior inspector is awoken. He sees an intruder tiptoeing into camp. Hecate begins her chant and rubbing her hands in the dirt. Now, she does an awesome job here, like Helen McCrory did as Evelyn Poole.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad she's not saying Uranus this time, though, because like, Evelyn was like, Uranus. But the thing I liked about this was if anybody who's ever spent any time on the beach, they know the tactile sense that comes with rubbing your feet or your hands in the sand. And that feeling of friction on your skin when rubbing, it's kind of arousing. And I could feel it vicariously a little bit. Not that I was getting aroused watching it, but you get this like sensation. And it actually made it a little bit disturbing because it's incongruous because you have like a sense of pleasure when you're watching someone bring forth deadly evil. So
that was a cool spell. I have to admit it was awesome.
But it seems at home with it though, to have like some sort of like pleasure sense being like triggered when you're doing some sort of evil thing. Like
yeah
that's how you get lured into doing all that evil shit, is because it's fun and it feels good and stuff like that. No one would do evil if it was like algebra. You know,
that's a good
everybody
point.
Would be a churchgoer because they'd be like, screw that shit. You know, come do evil with me. It's like calculus, only harder. You got to sell it. You know, you got to sell it.
Exactly.
So the junior inspector confronts Malcolmbury at the horses. Kaiatane is slitting throats. Rattlesnakes are emerging from the sandy depths. And these are what, you know, Hecate has drawn up. Kaiatane is now posed to slit a man's throat, a sleeping man, and he is face to face with a rattler. Tension is held for a moment, and then the rattler moves to strike. Kaiatane slices the man's throat, and he follows through, slicing his knife upwards, taking the head off the rattler. Kaiatane is bitten by another rattler that was in his blind spot.
I was wondering if he was going to not kill the man at first and just go for the snake because he could somehow realize where the snake had originated from or where its power came from.
Yeah.
But then he does both at the same time. So it's kind of,
we kind of had to kill the guy because everybody around him was waking up and you don't want him to wake up when you're straddling him with a knife.
That's bad.
You know, he had to kill that guy first. And then, I mean, it was a pretty slick move. He killed both of them, just a little slow on the second one.
Because you're put into this confliction about the character at that point in time because you're going, okay, he's confronted by what he recognizes to be evil, but he also wants to do this evil act of cutting this man's throat, but which he finds to be necessary. So what does he do? You don't get the satisfaction of knowing which one he would choose because he does both. So I thought it was pretty cool.
I like that they use the snakes too because of the last episode with the devil and the snake. You know, it was interesting.
It's the devil's asshole they're in, after all. So now Ostow and Rusk take cover behind a boulder, and Ostow shoots ineffectively at Malcolmbury. Hecate loves the music of her master. Rusk and Ostow look at their dead. So now back at the Bedlam Lab, Jekyll and Victor trade remembrances of how they were viewed by their professors at school. Victor comments on Jekyll's rage, though they seemed equally enraged to me. I didn't think Jekyll appeared to be more angry than Victor.
No, I agree.
Which was strange. So we soon learned that it has been 24 hours since Balfour has shown any sign of change, or consciousness for that matter. Dr. Jekyll talks of his rage and how he would like to feel like a lamb. Wouldn't Victor want to feel that too? Victor says no. Jekyll asks Victor if he will be able to follow through with Lily. Victor talks of his memory of Lily when she was perfect. And once again, his memory is making him a monster.
See, I can see that right there. That makes it make sense to me. Because his memory of her, which she has already told him, that memory was a lie. You know, it was a fabrication. It was false. So this memory that he's holding on to is what makes him a monster because it's driving him forward. So I guess if he's saying that if we get rid of all of the impetuses that are inside of our head, these incentives that drive us to these dirty deeds, then maybe we have a chance at not being monsters.
Well, I mean, when I think he looks at it that way, that because Victor says this, right?
Mm-hmm.
About the memories.
Yeah.
I think because Lily was so good and nice to him when he thought she didn't have her memories. And then she gets her memories back and then she turns on him.
Ah.
You know what I mean? So he's like, without her memory, she's an angel again because she doesn't know anything.
So you're saying he's saying it without complete self-awareness at all. And it's ironic because of it.
That's a really good
point.
So
he's using it for her. Like, without her memory, she loved him. But when she got him back, or when he thinks she got him back, she totally turned on him and started her reign of destruction.
I like that. Yeah, I like that. I'm going with that.
Yeah.
That's my final answer.
It's suiting the cockiness. I mean, you can't have that type of cockiness without the lack of self-awareness, right?
Exactly. I do like the comedy in this scene, though, because the comedy in Penny Dreadful is always low-key, but when he's all like, he's imitating his teachers, he's just like, I find your methods questionable, Victor.
I bet they did.
And we find out Dr. Jekyll beat someone up.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I don't want to get back to the conversation too much about whether or not he's on the serum at this point, or how much he's on the serum, or yes, because they haven't, this is what, the fifth episode? And they haven't really given us a scene where he's doing that yet. So it's just...
No, it'll be the last episode that we get it. Right before the end of the episode, he'll change a little, and then it'll be the end till next season.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. It's going to be a...
Jerks.
So Balfour awakens. He is nonviolent and does not remember the doctors at all. Mr. Balfour is shocked at the idea that he would have tried to assassinate the queen, voicing that he loves her and would never want to do so. Victor believes him. Pride before the fall. How many times do you need to fall, Victor?
At least a couple more, apparently.
Dawn in the desert. Rusk closes the junior inspector's dead eyes, and the marshal asks if he plans on taking Ethan in alive. Rusk disavows his code and vows to kill Ethan and butcher all of his kind.
Now
he says he's going to shoot him in the back.
Yeah, that's a dangerous man right there.
Well, he doesn't even have Hecate applying her silver tongue to him whatsoever, and he's still going this way.
Yeah, well, he doesn't even have a gun, so he's not shooting anybody.
No, he has a gun now.
Pew, pew.
He picked up somebody's gun.
Was it the dead marshals? Because was he carrying a gun?
No, because he said Scotland Yard inspectors do not carry guns. And Austal was like, oh, you're going to fit in real nice out here in the West. And then now he has a gun. So
the junior inspector had Malcolm Murray at gunpoint.
Well, yeah, he had a gun because he was probably like, this is ridiculous. Everybody has guns. I'm getting one. Is that cool?
He wrote in his journal. That's what he was writing. He was just like, I'm getting a gun today. I don't care what Rusk says. He can be such a big jerk sometimes.
Yeah. Or he was probably like, I got a gun. It's exhilarating.
Rusk isn't even my real dad. And he keeps trying to tell me.
All the other cowboys are taking me serious now.
Now he's a poster boy for the anti-gun movement. As soon as you get a gun, you get killed by one. Boom.
By Malcolm Murray's sweet gun.
Yep.
So Ethan and Hecate are hastening through the desert when Ethan's horse gives out. He shoots it in the head to put it out of its misery. Hecate asks, and when this one dies, he says, so will we.
Man, what a harsh, unforgiving place. If you've ever spent any time out in the desert, even just like a couple of miles in, it's scary when you start to think about, like, you really let your mind go and go, okay, what if I was out here and I could walk in any direction for days without reaching water or shelter or anything, food.
Ugh, awful.
Vicky arrives home to his neglected and messy lab. He sits on his bed and pulls Lily's nightgown to his face and smells it. He actually shudders. After he does so, it's in the closed captions.
Oh, wow.
He gets up and begins to clean, starting with her nightgown and then on with the rest of the place. He seems content and ready by the end of the scene. He's preparing for Lily's homecoming.
That's what I thought, too.
This is the worst cleanup montage ever.
Yeah.
Ever. He wipes down one table and then an edge of that nasty tub, you know, that he's pulling her dress up out of. And it's like, you didn't get anything clean.
No.
You probably just
total
made your
guy cleaning.
Yeah, you just made your floor wet is all you did.
We're good.
Yeah.
He thought he did a good job.
Shoved everything else under his bed. All right. She'll never know. Perfect.
Like, compare this to when Vanessa Ives cleaned up Malcolm Murray's estate. Oh, night and day.
She Cinderella'd the floors. I mean, she was on her hands and knees.
She got the next morning birds were putting on her dress.
Oh, scorpions.
So in a cave, Ethan lights a fire which illuminates pictographs telling the story of the origins of the Apaches. Hecate wonders if it's the origin or is it the prophecy of how the world will end. And it's a good question because, you know, you got the Norse concept of their apocalypse, and it involves Fenrir swallowing the sun. And that's what that pictograph actually made me think right away when I first saw it.
So this is the story of the original Apache, who was the one who fought the darkness. Now, remember, Kaietne says in the dream, or in their like spirit meeting, he says to Ethan, "You are the Apache I seek." I wonder if he was being singular in that, or...
Ah, the boy who...
That's a really good point.
Like, the one who's going to fight the darkness. So this is how...
Nice.
Yeah.
Maybe.
That's really good. Cool. I think that goes perfectly with
it. I do, too. I think you're onto something.
Possibly.
So meanwhile, Malcolmery and Kaietne have their own fire ablaze, and Kaietne assesses his wound. It is possible he may not survive the night, so he reveals more to Malcolmery. Kaietne talks of how he was abandoned by his family and how he had wanted to die. He had received a vision preventing him from dying. In this vision, he saw the world cast into darkness with the animal of the night prowling the streets. He saw Ethan. Kaietne says if they lose Ethan tonight, the night will never end. It's interesting that Ethan in his vision did not look like a wolf, but he still had blood in his mouth. He almost kind of looked like a thrall.
But, that's a good point. I didn't think about that.
But he was not in wolf form.
He just had blood. Didn't he have black eyes?
Black eyes and blood in his mouth.
Huh. Interesting.
That would be something.
Maybe he can turn it on and off. I don't know.
Maybe if when the darkness takes place, he doesn't have to be in wolf form anymore. Maybe it's just, I don't know.
I don't know either.
What would happen, though, if that's what was going on, if Dracula wins? You know what I mean? Because he's not there to defend. Ethan's not there to defend Ives. Dracula gets his fangs into her, literally and figuratively, and then everything turns to dark. Ethan turns dark, and then he becomes a thrall to Dracula.
Well, question, if the devil gets Ethan, does he still need Ives? Or if the Dracula gets Ives and the devil has Ethan, is it just like a fight? Or...
Because Lupus Day is the key to protect her, right? Or to save it in the end.
Yeah.
At least just to save it in the
end. I think so.
And that has to involve her, right?
So. I guess.
His function seems to be to protect her from either one of them. But if the other one gets to him first through Hecate, perhaps.
Well, because Hecate's telling him that if you come with us, we'll do this together without her. You know what I'm saying? Like, we'll be the ones to recreate this world. I know.
It could either go that way, or they just take her protector out. That's
all together.
That's part of the game, right there. You know,
that's probably it. It's quite a leverage piece with her, also. You know, because she loves him. And at the beginning of this, Kaietne said that he had come back to die, right? And this is where he says it: "I'd come back to die, but then I had this vision," which makes me feel like he really does want to save Ethan, even though he knows, because he says it, when Ethan sees me, he's going to kill me, you know? So it kind of put me at ease about him, just at the fact that he has nefarious, you know, intentions for Ethan, you know what I mean? So I'm actually okay with him now, even though what he does later, but I have something to add to that when it comes around. So
yeah. When his dad says, "You brought the devil to my doorstep," that makes me go, wait a minute.
Oh, for sure.
Okay, so now Hecate asks Ethan if he is the savior or is he the wolf. He remembers when he camped inside that cave for weeks and how they raided his dad's ranch. He promises to send his father to hell and laugh while he does it. He is done trying to be good, and suddenly they are having sex after some soft focus camera work, doggy style. While in the act, she tells him when he kills his father, he needs to promise himself to Lucifer. More precisely, he has to say that he is his animal. Subsequently, he will never feel guilt again.
Well, I guess you have to do a doggy style with a werewolf, right?
I mean, some people have had a problem with this.
Really?
Yes, and I think it's in feedback. I was part of a discussion group on Facebook, and it was quite hilarious, actually. But
And another reason why you would do a doggy style, too, is because if she flickered into her demon form, that would totally be a mood killer.
Yeah. Big time.
Right?
Yeah. Turn her around. Less to look at back here. I think they should have extended this scene, and we should have had her get on all fours and be like, this way. Because she's the one who's trying to influence him to embrace that side. And if we could see that she initiated it, it would not seem as silly.
And this could be a spell also, to where she's kind of getting a little control too.
Yeah, and I wondered if it's possible that he's being charmed by her like Malcolm Murray was with Evelyn Poole. And I think Malcolm Murray thinks that's what's going on actually with him. But yeah, some people felt that this scene was – the doggy style was a little too on the nose or on the snout.
I didn't even notice it until you said it. It was like, oh, it was doggy style. Hey, you know, like Steve said, it's a subtle humor, you know.
Well, the first time Ethan has sex with anybody in this entire series, it was doggy style.
Hmm. Yeah, and she whispers some pretty important information mid-coitus too. You know, she's like, oh – when you kill your dad, tell the Satan you're his puppy, and everything's gonna be fine.
Talk about a mood killer right there. You know, it's just I would stop and be like, "Are you into this or what?"
Maybe we can... I don't know if I'd stop. At least try and move on, and then afterwards ask her. But
see, she's not as good as she thinks as she is at her silver tongue ways, because I feel like that was a little too obvious. And also, maybe this is a signifier, because when he had sex with the woman, he didn't even bother to learn her name. He had sex with her doggy style in the first episode of season one. And with Rona, it was actually in a bed, you know, and like lovingly and stuff. So this might indicate that he is playing Hecate.
I hope so.
The fact that they did a doggy style. So we'll see.
I would have liked an extension of the scene as well. Like Em said, to have her kind of like on all fours doing that, you know, just because it would give us more information as the viewer, and you would be able to
see Sarah Green on all fours.
Yeah, I was going to go there too. Yeah. You know, but having her be like the seductress would give us a bigger clue as to how this is going.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
He's just dial 1-900.
And at least they were in a cave and no one was chasing them. You know,
so yeah.
It was a proper moment.
Yeah, they waited till they were like undercover to light a fire.
Exactly. Away from people hunting them. Yes.
So the next day, they also think everybody's been killed, too. They don't realize Malcolm Murray and Kyatine are out there, too. Next day, they drink their last drops and Ethan fatalistically throws away the canister.
Why would you throw it away?
I thought the same thing.
I was like, dude.
I know. I was like, you just because you think you know the desert doesn't mean you actually do. I mean, you might find some water and then you'd be like, God damn it. What did I do with that canister?
Yeah, quarter mile away, he finds it. And he's like, ah, fuck.
You're down your hands and knees drinking like a dog. But I decided it was fatalistic. So, and that made it a little better. So they depart with one horse, and soon we see they are down to just the two of them. She is soon overcome, and Ethan begins to carry her. He doesn't make it very far when he falls to his knees. It seems hopeless, and then a horse is heard neighing. Malcolm Murray and a wounded Kyatine ride closer to Ethan. Malcolm Murray dismounts and walks to Ethan. Ethan asks, "What the fuck are you doing here?" Malcolm Murray gives him the canister and is disappointed to see Ethan share the water with the unconscious Hecate. Malcolm Murray stands and pulls his gun to shoot Hecate dead. Ethan then pulls his gun and threatens immediate retaliation and told Malcolm Murray he should not have come. More horses are heard coming. Ethan's father's men have arrived to finally succeed at taking Ethan home. They ask Ethan what they should do with Kyatine, and Ethan suggests to leave him out in the desert. Malcolm Murray protests this move, and Ethan says, "Let him burn." Now, this is why I have doubt that I want to believe he hasn't turned, but the fact that he prevented Malcolm Murray from killing her right on the spot tells me that maybe it has turned, that he does have affection for her, because why not have her killed right there if he, you know what I mean?
I see what you're saying. It does really indicate that he would be feeling something genuine for her, if only some sort of protectiveness of a helpless woman.
Yeah, I think it's that. I think it's that he's got, you know, he's still a little bit good in the fact that it's defenseless, helpless woman. If she was in her demon form and he was in his right mind, they would have killed her a long time ago.
And even if you would consider, even if you like give some credence to the idea that she's putting a spell on him, you have to stop and think about, okay, if she's unconscious and at death's door, what would the efficacy of that spell be at that point?
Right.
So,
And maybe he thinks he can turn her. So that's a possibility. And so
Malcolm Murray should have just done the right thing and plugged one in her real quick. And then
Ethan would have killed him. Yeah.
Well, you know, sometimes you have to do something for the greater good.
Yeah.
I like Malcolm Murray, but that's what I thought. It was like, just plug her, man. It's the right thing to do. You know, Ethan was in poor shape. He probably could have, like, kicked the gun out of his hand and then shot her. You know, and they just beat him down real quick.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I'm glad the way it happened, so it's all right.
So, speaking of Ethan in poor shape, he is nursed awake by his father, played by Brian Cox. His father says he is so happy he is home and that he loves him.
Creep.
He does a good job of playing these rotten parts because he does it in the X-Men movies. He's had several of these parts, and it's a good casting choice because right when I saw him, I was like, oh, his dad's going to be a total douche.
Yeah.
So it's nice.
Yeah, we saw him in The Ring, and I've seen him in a ton of stuff. He's one of those actors you see
everywhere.
Yeah. So Malcolm Ray gets dressed in his room. A knock at his door eventually leads him before Jared Talbot. Talbot welcomes Malcolm Murray to his home. And when they are standing face to face, he says it is like standing before a mirror.
Yeah, right. He wishes.
Yeah.
He gives Malcolm Murray some weeded whiskey to try. Malcolm Murray asks after Hecate and would like to see her. Talbot says she is resting and that he would like to lead the conversation now. He asks why Ethan had been living at Malcolm Murray's house. And Malcolm Murray says he conscripted Ethan's services to help him find his daughter, Mina. Talbot expresses sympathy for the loss of his daughter.
So, fun fact about Weller's whiskey. It was William LaRue Weller, the owner of the company. And in 1849, he replaced rye with wheat. And it came out to a much smoother taste and kind of made the separation between the two. So I don't know if one of them's necessarily, I guess his would be more of a bourbon thing and the other one, the rye whiskey.
Yeah, and which, Maker's Mark is a wheated whiskey. And we've had Weller's before.
It's good also. Stuff. I prefer the wheat over the rye myself.
I like the rye. Yeah. I'm not going to lie. But I've been drinking more scotch, and I think that's what they use for it. So I think it's all what you're in the mood for with it, you know?
So Hecate awakes and is surrounded by dolls once again, which was pretty funny.
The subtle humor always nails it.
I don't know. Is this her past making her monstrous? And okay, so Malcolm Murray and Talbot talk of the depictions of a bloodthirsty beast that was painted by Audubon. But it's interesting that it's a wolf. Even it looks like a cat, but it's a wolf that is gnawing on a bone.
Cool.
And he also says bloodthirsty beasts are at home there. And but he's referencing the desert, but you also wonder if there's another meaning behind that.
Hmm.
Talbot brags how there are mountains named after him. And this reminds me of Peter asking his father during the seance if he named that mountain after me or after him. And Malcolm Murray, Malcolm Murray responds with at what cost. And obviously he knows what cost because of Peter and Mina. He says, your son hates you. What do you want from me? Talbot wants to know why he was riding with Kayatene. Again, Talbot likens himself to Malcolm Murray. Malcolm Murray says that they are not alike. And Talbot says, yes, in agreement, that he at least has one child yet still alive.
Ooh, damn. Burn.
He says Ethan will live out the rest of his days in this home and that Malcolm Murray will assist him. So it makes you wonder how many days he's planning on letting Ethan live.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably why he wants him to repent so bad, so he can kill him.
Whack him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So get him right with God and then kill him, even though he's threatening to kill him if he doesn't do it. So I guess because he says he's trying to save his soul. So he's like, I guess in his head, he's like, you're going to die either way. So go ahead and repent. Ask for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. You can go to heaven and then I'm going to do you in.
And why would he be more concerned about Ethan's soul rather than his? He's just like resigned to the fact that he's going to go writhe in the fires of hell.
Because in his head, it's still his son. You know what I mean? So he's like, I'm doing you the favor. You're going to go to heaven if you repent. So do it so I can kill you where I go to hell. Because he's obviously done some terrible things to the Native Americans to have that land, and he's going to end up killing his own son. So that's pretty terrible.
Maybe that's what it is, because killing your own family members, what is that called? There's a word for that.
Fratricide.
And maybe there's just no chance of forgiveness, but it's worth it to him because of the horror of what Ethan brought upon the family.
Oh, for sure. Plus, I mean, he does. He talks about, the Native Americans being on his land and getting them off. And even Kayton, he's like, I came back to my land, So they did some pretty nefarious things for sure.
Yeah, and the fact that he doesn't even see them as humans.
Mm-hmm.
So Hecate now visits Ethan at his bedside. She says that he saved her life. He says that she would have done the same. She reminds him of what he has to do, and he says it has been a long time coming. Now, this is the this particular scene, it wasn't until I got to the scene that I had the first thought that he's playing her. It's just something about it. I don't know why, but it didn't. He didn't seem genuine to me.
So what? Let's assume for a second. Let's just play devil's advocate and say that he is playing her. Why? What is he getting out of that? What is he trying to get her to do?
I don't know. I can't figure it out. Like maybe.
Like we would have.
I just don't know.
We would have to assume that he needs her to perform some sort of function, right? And he has to like trick her into doing so. I just can't come up with what it would be that he needs her to do.
Well, I mean, if anybody's going to save him from his dad at the end of this, it could be her from melting outside of a wall. Whoop.
Yeah.
And then she'd be there. That would be the one thing. But other than that, like at this point, but then why wouldn't he just let her die in the desert? I think she's just got him under his spell, just like Evelyn Poole and Michael Murray.
Or if maybe he's using her to allow him to get closer to Satan so he can take Satan out.
Sweet. Now that would be metal.
And plus it helps it make sense because it just seems so sudden for him to turn like that, but it felt very out of character and rushed. Okay. The door opens and Ethan is being summoned to meet with his father. His father says Ethan is not there to make amends, but to save his soul. Ethan asks, how could he have killed the innocent people on the train just to get him right with God? Talbot doubts the innocence of the people on the train and mentions Ethan's sister. He brings Ethan into the chapel so that Ethan could see what the Apaches had done. Talbot tells a harrowing tale of how Ethan's older brother, his mother, and little sister were murdered before Talbot Sr.'s eyes. Ethan is hearing this story for the first time, it seems. I don't know that for sure, but it seemed that way. He tells Ethan that he brought the devil onto his doorstep and gave him the key. Talbot demands that Ethan get down on his knees in repentance. If he doesn't do so, he threatens to send him to hell and pulls out his gun. Ethan says he's done repenting. End of episode.
So do you guys think his sister's dead?
I was wondering that maybe she is still alive.
She can't see. She can't speak.
Why isn't she sleeping in her room?
His dad might be fucked up and keeping her somewhere else. I don't know. It was awful. I was like, oh, she could be alive because he never says how she died and everybody else. He tells how they died.
Yeah, it could be some weird relationship like the governor on
that's what I was thinking deck. Too that's the first thing that came to mind was the governor. Maybe that's what like Talbot Sr. is going to try to use to push Ethan over the edge to get him to repent, is to like go and I have your sister right here.
Yes.
You know, and then they show her and he's like, oh my god.
Now I understand why Kayetane did this, because he keeps Ethan alive to kind of like force him to live with the guilt and everything that's going on and use him as a tool to kill the U.S. soldiers, right? The cavalry. So then he gets a chance because, you know, they're pretty much going to lose because they're out of men. They're outgunned, and he gets a chance because Ethan's dumbass is like, let's go to my family's house and steal. So he has the chance to strike at the people that are kind of like taking over his land, and he gets complete revenge on Ethan before he had this vision of Ethan being the savior, because Kayetane, I think, wanted to die anyway, like he says. So he goes and wipes out his family to get like 100%. You killed, I mean, it sounds like Ethan like slaughtered people that were close to him. So it made sense to me. I was like, wow, I mean, you want to talk about really getting complete revenge. Now he's got to live knowing that you led me into your home and then I did the exact same thing you did when you had the chance.
That makes sense. And that's the first time I've actually felt firm in believing that Kayetane is good. Because especially since you mentioned the fact that this happened before he had the vision of needing to make sure that he goes to the good side.
Because he came back to die. He was like, I wanted to die in my own land, but then I got this vision. And then he went on his quest to go save Ethan. Because without him, the rest of his people and the whole world falls into darkness.
And it makes sense, too, that it would be Kayetane that would be chosen for that vision. Because he basically committed the same crimes as Ethan. So it's almost like this mirror image again, which like the show likes to play with. He's probably the one who actually put the knife to his sister.
Yeah, oh, for sure. That's how I looked at it. All of it was under his guidance, you know, so it's crazy.
So there,
and then maybe his dad cursed him to become the wolf, you know, maybe his dad made a deal to curse him to become the wolf. I don't know. That's just something I'll throw out there. I doubt it, but it's possible.
Yeah, we didn't get any answers on that. Makes you wonder, though, because both Kaitane said something about them doing monstrous, so it has to be the killings. But it does make you wonder, wait a minute, is this about turning into werewolves? But then you've got Talbot Sr. with the bloodthirsty animal wolf painting.
I can't wait till Sunday.
So anything else before we move on to feedback?
No, I think we covered it. I was going to mention something about the uncertainty on the whole wolf issue, who knows and who doesn't. I feel like at this point, Kaitane does know, and I'm going to go with Talbot Sr. not knowing.
Yeah, for sure.
That's
unless he's the one that cursed him, but I doubt
so that's,
it.
So that's like the outlier chance. Doubted. But if it's not that, then he's like oblivious to it.
Exactly.
Cool.
Yeah, because why would he think that he could save his soul then?
Right.
Back in 1892. I mean, if you lived in 1892 and somebody was a werewolf, do you think that you could save their soul just by making them get on their hands and knees?
Nah.
Maybe if he had a silver bullet.
Maybe he had another meaning when he said, get on your knees and repent.
All right. Time for feedback.
All right. First up, it's time to buckle up. It's Bib.
Ooh, Bib off the get-go.
She says, ow. First off, not sure I want to see Sir Bond in a cowboy hat. And to that, I say, why not?
Yeah,
I think he looks pretty good.
Yeah, he looks pretty good.
The non-West looks stunning. And Kaitane, your name baffles me, sir, is determined. Well, well, well. Isn't Vicky a smug bastard with a giant needle? Rapidly becoming less attractive. I prefer junkies, apparently. Those are Bib's words, not mine.
Well, he's a junkie for Lily's nighty now, so maybe that will repair him for you.
Remind me not to piss Rusk off.
Yeah, no kidding. You don't want that guy in your ass.
For fuck's sake, Kekite, you're a damn witch. Make some water.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people complain about this, and I've thought about it, and it seems like, you know, she wouldn't be really equipped to bring any life-giving type of benefit. It would be more something that's going to take life. So it makes sense that
she like dry up the water.
Yeah, or you know, to bring up snakes that are going to kill people, but to actually sustain life, I don't think she's going to.
And even if you look at like the opposite of water being fire, she wasn't even able to do that.
Right.
This chick can call up like snake demons out of the sand to kill people, but she can't make a fire.
Seems like yeah, they can work with demons, they can work with charming people, baby hearts.
Yeah. They could do a lot of cool shit, but like they're not Boy Scouts.
Voodoo dolls.
Sure. Wolf and witch flirty in the desert. It's a weird flirt, but it's flirting. Hecate backstory is unsettling. Talk about fucking your kid up.
Yeah.
Did Papa Wolf catch Ethan Wolf in a compromising situation? Make a man out of you? The euphemism for don't be gay?
Maybe.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Ethan seems pretty comfortable in his spectrum, which is properly straddling both sides.
Yes, exactly. I was about to say we're forgetting about Dorian, but yeah, both sides.
And he flirted with Lyle with no problem. So
that's true.
Dueling Ethan backstories. Nice touch. As opposed to the bad touch, which never. Thee and me about to unleash demons in the desert. Ethan goes for it. Gadzooks.
Yeah.
Jesus H. Christ, Bond. Junior Inspector snuck up on you. Serpent attack. Ah, the music of the night. Footnote. Junior Inspector appears in Vikings and Game of Thrones. More support from my limited number of actors in the UK theory.
Was he the guy in Vikings that Auslaug had put the hot iron in his hands?
It's possible.
The Christian?
Yeah, let us know who that is, because I'm curious now.
We can easily look it up right now. But
oh, Vicky, don't go basing your happiness on another person. You'll be disappointed, especially in Billy Lily. Rusk goes super badass in the desert. Damn. Vicky in his crap lab snorting a garment I do not wish to identify. What an odd bird. I can identify it if you want, Bib. I know what it was. Seriously, she can conjure snakes but can't locate water? Lame. Who is turned on by Junior Witchy Poo? Doing it doggy style, of course. She's okay running around naked when bald, but apparently not in a cave in the desert when no one else is around. Seriously. She has no shade or revitalization spells. Willow would kick her ass.
Well, she could be doing this just to get Ethan to feel like she's protecting her. You know, she probably doesn't need it at all, but it's part of her game to get Ethan to like really feel like, oh, I'm her protector. You know, she's like my companion right now at this point.
So she's purposely like bringing out the alpha male protective qualities.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How did Bond and Coyote get to them first? Nice response, Ethan. Well, thanks for the water. Whoa, actual dad. Do not rip on Scotch whiskey, you bastard.
Amen.
Ugh, yeah, right. God wanted you to kill the native people. Oh, great. They both have mountains named after them. Vainglorious. Maybe my favorite word. Bam. Papa Ethan goes for the I've still got a child kill.
What's the slam of all slams?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
A reckoning. That's always fun. Go for it, Ethan. Oh, thank God. Thought Ethan Wolf killed Sis for a moment. This is one macabre shrine, sir. Mm-hmm. This is one horrible story. Understandable that he holds a grudge. Are you shitting me? Well, at least this isn't the season ender. Once more, no Lyle. The end. Coming up, Dark Ethan. I might have said, woohoo, loudly.
So it sounds like you believe he's turned. Or at least or at this point you did.
Or he's about to.
Yeah.
Mm. All right. Thanks, Bib.
Thank you, Bib.
Yeah, thank you, Bib.
All right. Up next, KoalaCon. Back again. First things first. Everyone I've talked to about this episode had an issue with Ethan hooking up with Hecate. I get it, though. He just likes the crazy chicks. A hot, horse-loving, mankind-hating, dark arts-using chick. Pretty much describes my girl in my first long-term relationship. 8 years of on-again and off-again angry sex and bickering makes me love Ethan all the more. That's why he needs Vanessa. Just the right balance of crazy and normal human reactions. And we get this season's fuck line from Ethan. Who the fuck are you people? Oh, fuck me. What the fuck are you doing here? West Studi, you were always the angry Huron, fake Mohawk and last of the Mohicans to me, and I'd have it no other way. Ethan's father. Is it scarier that he isn't a werewolf, but just a self-righteous zealot who thinks whatever he does is justified to achieve his goals? To steal a line from another show, there's nothing worse than a monster who thinks he's right with God. I know he said he's going to hell, but I think the sentiment holds up. Like West Studi, the actor has a resume, but watching him in this, all I could see was Agamemnon. This also worked for me. Vic and Dr. Jekyll, that tension is rising like a fresh loaf of bread, but Victor looks like he's trying to get his life together, cleaning up and we don't see him using, unless he's making the place nice for when he thinks Lily is coming back. Poor delusional bastard. About as bad as thinking a crazy chick will change the fourth time around and just plunging back into it. I would also like to join the John Clare Smash Prediction Group. Yes. Sorry for the length. Tried to keep it short, but this episode has fired the mind and I needed to vent it out. 9.5 syringes for this one in my mind. Thanks, KoalaCon.
Thanks, KoalaCon.
I don't think that Victor's... Yeah, thank you, for sure. I don't think that Victor's cleaned up at all. I think he's just trading one, like, form of smack for another. He's not injecting a chemical into his veins anymore, mm-hmm. but he's injecting himself emotionally with the delusion and the obsession that he could have Lily back the way he remembers her, which was always a fabrication anyway.
I think he might still be shooting up on the side, personally. You know, but that's just me. I thought at that one season too, you know, he just might have it a little more under control and not just, you know, getting ass fucked up. I think he still has a little in his system though.
I just hope either way. I mean, I think he's done with it and I hope he stays done with it because I really don't want to see him back to doing it again once this Lily shit blows up in his face. It will blow up in his face.
Well, I'll tell you exactly the next moment he does it. Mr. Hyde's going to show up at his house, scare the shit out of him. He's going to realize he helped create him. Hyde's going to let him live, and then he's going to go back inside and get really fucked
up. Yeah, because that's how he medicates with his guilt. Uh-huh.
He self-medicates.
I helped make another one. Fuck.
All right. Up next, we have Kelly G, and she says, hello, I have listened for a bit, and this is my first time writing in.
What's up, Kelly?
First time writer.
Yeah,
how you doing?
Thank you.
I wanted to say I really enjoy your podcast and how each person brings a unique and interesting view to the show. I love Penny Dreadful, and I think it is one of the best shows on television. I never understand why it doesn't get more buzz, but I am glad I found your podcast. I thought this episode was good, but not great. I enjoyed Ethan's character, but this was a lot of Ethan with very little understanding of his motivations. Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. Huh? Mm-hmm. As Lupus Day, I would think that turning to evil would be a huge struggle for him. But no, all it takes is a hot witch and he's down with Lucifer. I hope in the future we see him really wrestling with this. How can he forget that Hecate was at least partially responsible for Senbenny's death? I will say that Hecate seems way less powerful right now. She can't summon water or keep horses from dying, or even herself from dying. This is not the same Hecate we saw before, but the snakes were cool. Maybe channel that power into finding water next time, Hecate. Hecate the goddess was most often associated with dogs, serpents, the moon, and also with crossroads. All that's applicable when you think about it, though.
Especially mm-hmm. with Ethan.
Yeah, that's really a good point.
In some representations, she is formed with three heads, a dog, a horse, and a serpent. Aha. Mm-hmm. All in the same episode, if you consider Ethan to be the dog, or at least the doggy style. How interesting that we saw all these animals in this episode. I should just read this and not interject. I was surprised to see her treat the horses with compassion, but it makes sense as they are her special animal familiars. Hmm. And we see that Ethan is at some kind of crossroads. Will Hecate sway Ethan to the darkness? I like him better with Vanessa, honestly. There is something really compelling watching both of them always trying to fend off the evil inside of them. At any rate, even though there was no Vanessa, I still enjoyed it. Can't wait to hear your discussion. Thanks again, Kelly G. Thank you, Kelly. Nice.
Yeah, thanks, awesome. Kelly.
Awesome. Thanks for the little lesson about Hecate, because it's all pertinent mm-hmm. information, and it all makes sense that...
Yeah, and he's definitely at a crossroads, and...
I think it's a little bit of a teaser, you know?
Yeah.
I think Vanessa's got her flirtations going on with mm-hmm. Dracula, and who knows where that's going to go. And then Ethan's got his stuff going on, and then they're going to kind of like ditch both of those losers and meet in the middle.
Well, maybe Kaetane comes in and sells him, like saves him, not sells him, but saves him. Because you know he's not dead.
No.
You know, I mean, come
on.
No,
he's not.
Nah.
Thanks, Kelly.
Well, yeah, thank you, Kelly.
All right. Next up, Princess Butterqueen.
Oh, Butterqueen.
Hi, No Shippers. It took me a couple of viewings to appreciate this episode. I give it 8 little scorpions. Not my favorite, but it's still up there. I think that I was so blown away by last week's episode and was hoping that we would see Vanessa pre-op with JC by her side, defending her from Dracula.
Whoa, pre... Oh, okay. Never mind.
She says, I'm glad the Ethan story is coming out now, and I'll be excited to find out how he became a werewolf. Plus, he will finally stop uttering the words, my father. We started a drinking game at my house, one drink for every time he says, my father.
Oh, Jesus. Ooh. Who's died of liver failure so far?
It was also nice to see the softer side of Hecate. While I'm still shipping Vanessa and Ethan, at least we saw Hecate in a somewhat different light. I imagine that she'll either cross over to the good side or end up like her mother, but at least she'll have a new set of dolls at the ready. Ooh, what if she does use the dolls?
Game. Yeah, she's just going to be playing with them. Oh, thank you, Paula Butter. No, I'm Vanessa.
Would you like some tea, Ethan?
Yes, I would, Vanessa. That would be very nice.
Mm-mm. Right.
Well, the Hecate doll and the Ethan doll. Doctor.
It'll look like a Team America, you know, when they're the little puppets are having sex and everything.
Oh, yeah. I'm tired of doggy Ethan.
Princess Buttercream goes on to say, it seems like the old gang needs to save Ethan this time, like they did for Vanessa and Malcolm in previous seasons. Hopefully he'll snap out of it soon. I didn't quite buy his evil side, but there are still 4 more episodes. No real comments on Victor's story, except it looked like that needle would really hurt. Cheers, Princess Buttercream.
Oh, thank you for the wonderful email.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm the only one that's not quite sold on this Ethan thing.
Next up, mm-hmm. it is the Queen of Winter, Mab. Mm-hmm. She says, greetings, Dreadfuls. I wanted to throw a possibility out there for John Clare's story arc, which may be addressed this coming Sunday or may not. I recently rewatched the whole series, and while I paid closer attention to some scenes and episodes than others, I couldn't have finished a full rewatch without multitasking. I tried to pay pretty close attention to John Clare. I think it's very possible he never forgot any of the stuff with Vanessa. Mm-hmm. I'll list the three main reasons and add that the general fourth reason is that I don't find anything to contradict the theory. Number one, when Lily finally acknowledges she is fully aware of everything that happened, she says, I may be paraphrasing, but the meaning was the same. I always knew, or I've always known, as though she never had to get her memories back. She was playing the doc from the start. Two, when Clary met Ivesy, when John Clare first meets Vanessa, he acts very startled that she sits down with him. At the time, of course, this simply seemed like a monster in shock that a beautiful woman would be kind toward him. However, nothing in his words or demeanor specifically supported the notion or disproved the possibility that he was reeling from recognition of a traumatic figure from his past. Mm. Huh. Three, this may be the biggest one. John Clare said in Season 2, Episode 9, true evil is, above all things, seductive. When the devil knocks at your door, he doesn't have cloven hooves, he is beautiful, and offers you your heart's desire in whispered airs, like a siren, beckoning you to ruinous shore. See? He doesn't use algebra, folks. He does that. This episode was also called Mirrors, something Vanessa once wanted to put behind the world and now dislikes. Also something John Clare once used to make Vanessa remember herself, and he also now presumably dislikes. I don't have a strong theory yet on what this would all mean, but I'm keeping an eye out for more clues that he has always known, and I'm interested in the John Clare story probably for the first time. Huh. P.S. Is anyone starting to soften towards Hecate after the little glimpse of her backstory we got in episode 5? I'm still holding out hope that she'll become a lovable villainess. I'm still holding out hope that we'll get a little glimpse of her backside, but that hasn't happened yet. So, no, but to answer your question, honestly, yeah, she is. I wouldn't go so far. Given her past track record, I wouldn't go so far as to say that I've got a Team Hecate shirt at the printers right now. Mm-hmm. Not quite there yet. But yeah, softened a little bit.
So it sounds like,
yeah, for sure,
Mab wants to keep her as a villain, but lovable. A villain you love to watch.
Kind of like Lily.
It's a hard line to walk, especially in a show like this, mm-hmm. because even your heroes have done some pretty nasty shit, you know?
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So it's like the villains have to really come with it and be like Satan or Dracula.
Yeah, and it's a cool theory she has about JC, so definitely keep up and send us more clues that you find, so I'm going to start looking into it myself. I mean, who knows? You know, he seems so happy about the little memory he got recently, it's hard to tell if he's had them at all. You know, I don't know if he has.
I would love to believe that about John Clare, that he's, this whole time, he has been aware that this is Vanessa from, you know, the hospital, and he's just not telling her because he realizes that she doesn't remember because she got out of mm-hmm. that whole scenario and her memory was,
Jesus Christ,
you know, wiped, or however you want to put it.
And that would be an act of kindness on his part,
yeah,
towards her.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but Paul's right, because it does seem like he's starting to get these memories, like this is a new thing. So
yeah,
that's why I kind of doubt that he's remembered her this whole time, but we'll see.
You never know. Mm-hmm. Thank you for writing in.
Yes, as always, it's nice to hear from you.
Glad, Mab, you wrote in and let us know that this has changed your perception of John Clare. Because I was wondering, I actually put a call out for people to let us know if the last episode had influenced their opinion of him. And it sounds like it has for one person so far.
Nice.
So, all right. Thanks, Queen of Winter. Next up, Double D's. Hey, guys. Here is my problem with this episode. The words sound like answers, but they are just bigger questions. Why does he keep calling the senator's son he murdered his friend? He sounded like a douchebag. If Ethan was, quote, one of the Apaches, why did they slaughter his family? What is Kaitane's problem, mutilating his little sister like that? So was it stated that Kaitane did do it?
I don't think it was stated explicitly, but I feel like it was. I feel like it was him who did it.
Once that happened, why does he still call Kaitane his father? And why did he keep fighting alongside them for a time? Does he only hate his father for enlisting him against his will, or because he has a problem accepting responsibility, or is it because his father is the wolf? See, you're asking good questions, and it felt like Ethan was learning about this for the first time to me, so that could be why he was still calling him his father. And maybe it was Kaiatane involved, and that's why he refers to himself as the Almost Father, because he fell off that pedestal in his mind.
Ethan is unaware that any of this kind of stuff happened. He knew at some point mm-hmm. that his family got slaughtered, but he didn't know.
And that's why he dipped.
Right. That's why he left. But he traveled on with these people, with these Apaches, because he didn't know like what and when. So he just assumed that they had gone there and done their stated objective and then left.
Well, she's asking, if he knew that they slaughtered his family, why is he still referring to Kaiatane as his father, which he does rather affectionately when he talks to Hecate?
Yes, but you see, when they meet too, though, in the dream state, he's very hostile. Aggressive and asks about his family. You know what I mean? So it's
well,
like
to the point where we were wondering if he was actually the man he was referring to.
Exactly. But also now we know for sure because of the, you know, the backstory that we got. But look at what his own father has done. And he's still like my father. You know, it's just the way Ethan's programmed. You know what I mean? He's like, because he still had affection for him because of what they had gone through together. Because he felt like he was an Apache for a while. So he draws on that feeling that I was one of them, even though really Kaiatane was just punishing him in the long game. Like, I'm going to bring you in. And then when I get the chance, I'm going to kill your family and really punish you in the long run the way you've punished me. Because I have to live without my family because of you and your family. Does that make sense?
Yes. And so with her question, if Ethan was, quote, one of the Apaches, why they slaughter his family? Because it would hurt more, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you'd be more of a,
yeah, exactly.
You'd be more blindsided by the event, right?
Absolutely. He brought them into his home and they, I mean, they did exactly what he did. And he says it, I left him alive to punish him because he wanted to die. Just like Kaiatane wanted to come back to his own land and finally die, and he wasn't allowed to because of this vision, so he feels like he has a responsibility. He doesn't love Ethan. He just realizes he needs Ethan alive to save the world.
And so she's also asking, does he only hate his father for enlisting him against his will or because he has a problem accepting responsibility, or is it because his father is the wolf? That's a good question, because I was wondering, what is his enmity toward his father?
Well, his father kicked the shit out of him his whole life, because he says, you remember your brother, the one who kept you from, you know, me beating you,
yeah,
or the back of my hand. So I'm sure he was a rotten father. Plus the whole horse thing that happened, mm-hmm, that he told Vanessa about. He just doesn't sound like the dad of the year. Does that make sense? I mean,
yeah,
you see what,
yeah,
I'm saying? It's like we have a lot of backstory that his father was just a schmuck.
I don't even think you have to throw the wolf equation in there. What, that's like a separate question, whether his dad is a werewolf as well or not. I think Paul's hit the nail on the head there. His dad's enough of an asshole to where that doesn't even have to come into it for him to generate that mm-hmm. amount of hate.
So Donuts goes on to say, it seemed like Kaiatane made it sound like he'd cursed him with wolf nature, but then we see the American White Wolf painting in Jared's office, and I question that. I agree. So it should have been just a picture of a red herring.
We're getting mixed mm-hmm. signals here.
She says, I don't know if the fault is with Josh Hartnett or my perception of the storyline, but he says so little and doesn't really change expression that I don't buy that he's struggling with embracing the darkness, because his guilt and desire to be good are so deeply ingrained into him. His face really doesn't register the struggle. He only answers Hecate with more questions. So I keep waiting for him any moment to say, just kidding, and I have no doubts that he will. Oh, so you're sure that he's not turning. Well, okay, that gives me hope.
I don't know.
Yeah, jury's out on this one. When would be a good time to spring just kidding? Like, he could have, in the desert, like when she falls down from thirst, he could have been like, yeah, just kidding, see ya, and leave her out there to burn. So,
or pull out a pillow and just snuff her out, yeah, you know, like a nice big fluffy pillow. Go to sleep.
Victor's never going to get your body out here. You're dead, bitch.
Right?
So Donuts goes on to say, contrasting parallel, Jared dragging Ethan into the bloody chapel to remember himself, like somebody hauled Malcolm into the dining hall back when Malcolm was under the influence of Evelyn Poole.
Oh, nice.
And so maybe this will wake Ethan up if he is under a spell. Hmm. I think it's going to take Malcolm Murray to do it. Donut says, I did love Hecate summoning snakes and being so very evil and Poole, and I don't even care that they had sex. You want to have sex with your dead horse, sweaty dog, brimstone smelling selves? Go ahead. But I do kind of love her. And yeah, I think she's, like I already said before, it's fun to watch her because she does such a good job. Also, you know, I had said on the message board, like, you know, it's kind of a waste of fluids to be having sex when you're dehydrated. don't you think?
Yeah, that's not on the agenda. When you have that little water in you,
you're not feeling great. You probably got a headache.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you might think you're dying and you need to get some right before that. There's a possibility for it to work, you know?
Well, it's not going to cool you off, that's for sure. But I guess at night it's cold anyway. That's why they had a fire.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, she's a demon. Does she need fluids? I mean...
Apparently.
Yeah.
Or she's faking, too.
Yeah, it's a bunch of fakers. Yeah.
Donut says, for all the mirror talk, I thought the gleam shining in everyone's eyes was pretty amazing. Teenage Vanessa would be so proud. Contrasting with this, Balfour was injected through the eye to deaden his evil eye, and Mary's eyes were put out so that she would walk through the world of hell and misery instead of happiness. I noticed the gleams more so on Ethan and Kayatane. Victor looked creepy as fuck, but I found myself all out of sympathy I'd previously felt for him because he is clearly cruising for a bruising.
Oh, yeah.
Also, does Jekyll really just want to strip his rage away so he can bear out racism and rejection with grace? Because that ain't going away in 1892.
Yeah, right.
R.I.P. that guy, we hardly knew ya. I think she's talking about the inspector.
Junior inspector, yeah.
Mm.
Double D's, and then she's P.S. Kayatane is totally not dead, right? P.P.S. 7 out of 10 pennies. P.P.P.S. Is Kayatane the coyote? P.P.P.S. Why they always gotta ride horses till they're dead? Sorry, I'm drinking. And that was Donuts. She wrote a bunch of questions for us this time.
She's supposed to answer them, damn it.
She's taking us to task. What's up with that?
Well, she's been drinking.
Yeah. 7 out of 10 pennies? What's your damage, Donuts? Come on. This isn't that bad of an episode.
I found this episode enjoyable. I know I didn't say at the beginning what I thought of it. Overall, I enjoyed this episode. You know, my only complaint was really the sex scene, and I just think there should have been a longer sex scene.
That's what she said.
But or no sex scene at all, because... you know, if you take it out, it actually has a smoother run, the episode.
Yeah.
Well, I think everybody would have been a little bit easier on the sex scene if they had done it maybe, when they got to, Ethan's dad's house, you know, and they had a chance to recover, get some water in their systems, get a good night's sleep. And then, you know, maybe that scene isn't just a few hours long or covering a few hours worth of time. Maybe it's a couple of days long. They wake up and they're down the hall from each other and they kind of like look out the door. Hey, come down to my room.
Yeah, but we find out his dad's not going to let him recover much. True. You know, he was ready to be like all judgy, which is why I think Ethan could possibly go bad. I mean, it's definitely a possible because he's dealing with all the guilt, and she totally played into like give in to your evil side, and you won't have to deal with probably the most guilt you'll ever have in your life because you helped your family get slaughtered.
Take your weapon and strike me down.
Mm.
Exactly.
I will agree with her when she. Well, not that I disagree with the main body of the letter here, but one thing that stuck out for me that I really do agree with is that Josh Hartnett is not a bad actor by any. Stretch and he's done exemplary in this series, but I don't feel like he's really selling us on the push and pull that verve back and forth between the good and evil inside of him. I feel like there's not enough expression, there's not enough like verbal cues to let you know one way or another what he's actually feeling,
because there is trickery afoot. That's why, and he's probably not turning.
I'm hoping that we'll get the reveal, but I agree. It's a bit like, all right, you're cool with this now, you know?
Suddenly it happened to me right in front of my face.
And I just cannot hide it.
Finally, I don't know that one. You are on your own.
It's finally. Yeah.
I know the words. I know the song. I just don't know the words to join in because it's pretty funny.
Finally. All right. That's it, you guys.
All right. So thank you for joining us once again for our coverage and then feedback of the latest Penny Dreadful episode. We will be back on the same website, the same time next week, covering the next episode. Till then, be who you are. This is a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I'm your host, Em.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.